Time, the weekly news magazine, recreate from the pages of Time the first week of the United States at war. The March of Time.
Sunday, December 7th, 1941. The eastward rolling earth peels off the night. Gray light kindles low over the dark Pacific. It is almost dawn. There is a distant booming, but it is not the boom of the sea. In the western half of the United States, it is mid-morning. Church time for thousands.
Almighty God, who has given us this good land for our heritage, we humbly beseech thee that we may always prove ourselves a people mindful of thy favor and glad to do thy will. Bless our land with honorable industry, sound learning, and pure manners. Save us from violence, discord, and confusion, from pride and arrogancy, and from every evil way. Defend our liberty and fashion into one united people the multitude brought hither out of many kindreds and tongues.
While in the United States, churchgoers are hearing the common prayer for their country in critical times, in Honolulu it is 7:50 a.m., not even Sunday breakfast time. A lawyer named Roy Vitasek is warming up the motor of his little private plane.
Spinning overnight, Mr. Vitasek.
Okay. Great morning for flying, isn't it?
Yeah. Just a handful of clouds. And not a plane in the sky.
That's right. Well, come on.
Come on.
Three 3,000 feet aloft, lawyer Roy Vitasek levels off. Look down at the green loaf-shaped island of Oahu. And then Roy Vitasek looks south at Coco Head. Coming directly toward him, steadily, swiftly, are scores of big black bombing planes. They are nearly upon him before lawyer Vitasek can see that they are not the warcraft of his own country. Sunday, December 7th, 1941. It is 2:05 p.m. The Washington office of Secretary of State Cordell Hull. Japanese envoys Nomura and Kurosu arrive 15 minutes late for an appointment with Mr. Hull. Minutes pass as the tardy envoys, constantly consulting their watches, return the level stare of the bronze Lafayette from Washington, surveying them from across the room. Then, ushered into the office, Tennessee and Cordell Hull.
Come in, gentlemen. Take seat.
Thank you.
Yes. You have your government's answer to our government's proposals of November 26th?
Yes.
Let's see what it says. The United States is conspiring with Great Britain and the Far East. Both the United States and Great Britain have resorted to every possible measure to obstruct the establishment of peace. The Japanese government cannot tolerate, in view of the attitude of the American government, that it is impossible to reach an agreement. Mr. Nomura, I must say that in all my 50 years of public service, I have never seen a document that was more clouded with infamous falsehoods and distortions. Infamous falsehoods and distortions on a scale so huge that I never imagined until this day that any government on this planet was capable of uttering them.
Sunday, December 7th, 1941. It is 2:20 p.m. under the great White House portico. A uniformed United States soldier jumps from an army car, hurries up the steps.
Cordell from the Chief of Staff's office. Here's a sealed message from the decoding room at the Army Communications Office. Must be shown to the President immediately.
Sunday, December 7th, 1941. It is 2:25 p.m. in the almost deserted Washington office of Bill Peacock of the Associated Press.
What have you got for the night wire, Bill?
Nothing much. Routine Sunday stuff.
I'll get it. Associated Press.
Hello, Bill. This is Steve Early.
Oh, hello, Steve. Where are you, at the White House?
Oh, I'm calling from home. I've got the UP and the INS in the same wire.
Yeah, well, what's up?
I have a statement here that the president just called up and asked me to read. Quote, the Japanese have attacked Pearl Harbor from the air and all military and naval activities on the island of Oahu, the principal American base in the Hawaiian Islands. End quote. I'm going directly to the White House now. I'll tell you more later.
That was Steve Early.
Yeah?
Round up the staff and get him in here. I'm going over to the White House. We're in the war.
Operator. Operator, this is the Associated Press office in Honolulu. How about my call to San Francisco?
One moment, please. I think I finally reached your party.
Oh, good.
Go ahead, please.
San Francisco AP, Bartell speaking.
Hello, this is Burns, Eugene Burns in Honolulu. We're being bombed.
Yeah, Burns, we got a flash from Washington, but no details.
The attack is still going on. I'll give you what dope I have. Ready?
Go ahead.
From 50 to 150 Japanese bombers, dive bombers, and pursuit ships assaulted the island of Oahu this morning. At 8:10 a.m., the first squadron came roaring in from the southeast over Diamond Head, streaked northward over Pearl Harbor. Got that, Bartell?
Right.
The bombers circled over the U.S. Navy's Ford Island plane base in the harbor center. Dive bombers dropped to within 100 feet of the harbor surface, launched torpedoes at the many U.S. warships lying at anchor. From nearby Hickam Field, U.S. Army plane base, rose a barrage of anti-aircraft fire as a second wave of Japanese planes approached. The enemy...
Hey, James, that bomb must have fallen pretty close to you.
Yeah, it did. Something tells me I'd better give the rest of this report back. Now, here we go. The enemy scored direct hits on Hickam Field Barracks, killed over 100 U.S. soldiers. Wheeler Field got a blast on its hangars. Honolulu got incendiary bombs. Northward, machine gun fire raked the streets of the town of Wahiawa.
Just a minute, Gene. What town was that?
Wahiawa.
Okay, go ahead.
In Pearl Harbor, smoke rose as one vessel was set afire and another exploded. Other vessels steamed from Pearl Harbor in search of Japanese plane carriers. Getting this okay?
Just get that last part. Will you repeat, please?
Hello? Oh, Bartell? Hello? Hello? Say, operator, can't I get this call through?
Thus, after 23 years and 25 days of peace, the United States was plunged into its seventh major conflict. The attacker, the Japanese Empire, whose windows the U.S. had opened on the world just 88 years ago. In Washington, the White House announces 1,500 killed, another 1,500 wounded. Admits the loss of one capital ship, one destroyer. As the fateful news reaches the 132 million peace-loving, peace-making American people by radio, press, and neighborly word of mouth, these are some reactions. In San Francisco, it is just church time. A motorist drives into a filling station.
Better fill her up with ethyl.
You bet.
Hey, what do you think of those jets?
Yes? What jets?
They just bombed Pearl Harbor.
Are you kidding?
Just this minute, got over the radio.
Well, what do you know?
Yeah. Like this is it.
Gosh. And just now down the street, I almost hit a Jap on a motorcycle. Guess I should have run over it.
On the Cumberland Plateau in Tennessee, it is just after Sunday dinner. Sergeant Alvin Cullum York, legendary World War I hero, has told the news.
We got to put up a united front and give those folks a licking right away. Take care of the Japs first, and then take on the Germans.
As they struck the Russians at Port Arthur in 1904, while their ambassador danced before the Tsar, so once more the Japanese had delivered a copperhead punch. Their aim, to divide the U.S. fleets at Hawaii and Manila. Prevent a unified British-American blow on the Japanese fleet as it seemed to attack Singapore. Guam, Wake, and Midway Island, and soon the Philippines are raided by the far-flung Japanese. In Portland, Maine, the afternoon movies are beginning. Says one Yankee.
I feel sure of one thing. Up to today, I wondered whether we were another France. Too soft. But now we see that Americans can fight in the old way. I know Maine people can.
For the U.S., on this first Sunday afternoon, it becomes plain that this war will have to be won the hard way. Farther down the coast in Martha's Vineyard, same player Charles A. Lindbergh formally ends the cause of isolationism.
We must now turn every effort to building the greatest and most efficient army, navy, and air force in the world. When American soldiers go to war, it must be with the best equipment that modern skills can design and that modern industry can build.
The historic Sunday of December 7th ends. It is Monday, December 8th, 1941. At 12:25 p.m. in the chambers of the House of Representatives, members of the House and Senate hold a joint session, knowing that 20 hours and 25 minutes before, Japan had declared war on the United States and Great Britain. That Britain and the first of 18 other nations have declared war on Japan. Every important government official in Washington is present as Franklin Delano Roosevelt delivers his historic message. But none is more attentive than a group of 25 top-ranking officers in the Navy's Bureau of Aeronautics. These officers, some gray-haired, four stripers, a few commanders and a few of lesser rank, gather in the office of their chief, Rear Admiral Jack Towers, to hear the President's words by radio.
Confidence in our armed forces with the unbounding determination of our people, we will gain the inevitable triumph, so help us God. I ask that the Congress declare that since the unprovoked and dastardly attack by Japan on Sunday, December 7th, 1941, a state of war has existed between the United States and the Japanese Empire.
Ladies and gentlemen, you have just heard...
Gentlemen, we have work to do.
One minute after the President had spoken, the Senate, with not a single dissenting vote, the House with but one, declares war on Japan. On no issue was the United States ever so united. To a greater extent than at any time since he first took command during the choking depression 8 years ago, Franklin Delano Roosevelt could act with complete authority. He could fire, hire, demand, order, and get what he thought best and necessary, with perfect assurance that the country was solidly behind him. At 4:10 p.m., the President signs the war resolution passed by the Congress. Then, after a brief talk with Russian Ambassador Maxim Litvinov, who has just arrived in Washington, the tired chief executive relaxes on his office sofa, falls asleep, sleeps soundly for an hour. The office in which Franklin Delano Roosevelt takes his brief, well-earned rest once belonged to his old chief, Thomas Woodrow Wilson. It is the same office in which, one night 24 years ago, Woodrow Wilson wrote the stirring words which called his country into a great war. Words still remembered.
To such a task, we can dedicate our lives and our fortunes. Everything that we are and everything that we have, with the pride of those who know that the day has come when America is privileged to spend her blood and her might for the principle that gave her birth and happiness and the peace which she has treasured. God helping her, she can do no other.
Tokyo, Wednesday, December 10th. In the village of Hise stands the shrine of the sun goddess, most hallowed spot in all Japan. To the shrine comes a little man wearing thick spectacles, a ceremonial kimono, the black lacquered skullcap. He is the Emperor Hirohito, who believes he is a direct descendant of the sun goddess. Entering the shrine's innermost sanctuary, Hirohito places his wooden scepter under one arm, bows low. He claps his hands to summon the spirit of his distinguished astronomical ancestor with whom he wishes to confer. He has news for us. Impart within a swift, eager whisper.
Minnoko, Sannoko na. Watashi, Anata, Tahenshima. Nihako Niju Goban.
His message conveyed, he bows again, then walks out of the shrine backwards. Hirohito, the son of heaven, has just told the sun goddess that 3 days ago his government declared war on the United States and the British Empire. It is an auspicious day for this mystic conversation. Japanese troops have landed on the Philippine island of Luzon. First foreign troops to make a full-fledged landing on U.S. soil since the War of 1812. But reports Douglas MacArthur, commanding general of U.S. and Philippine forces in the Philippines.
German resistance has confined this action to the attack in the vicinity of Apari at the extreme northern tip of Luzon, where the Japanese attempted to establish a beachhead. Air activity continued in the vicinity of Manila, with intermittent attacks on airfields at Cavite and Nichols Field throughout the day. The situation is in hand.
Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, this morning, one story was the same. America's young men stormed recruiting offices, kept them open 24 hours a day. Many brought their toothbrushes and razors along in the hope of lessening delay. Typical are the scenes in New York City, where with voluntary recruiting at double the rate of World War I, the Navy finds fit and signs on in 2 days enough volunteers to furnish crews for 3 destroyers. The young men wait by thousands in the cold early morning, slowly shuffling to the service of their country. A newspaper man goes down the line asking questions.
Hey, what's your name, buddy? I'm from the Daily News.
Oh, a reporter, huh?
Yeah.
My name's Gordon Rome. I'm from Boykin Street, Brooklyn. I sure hope they got a place to sit down in the Navy. My feet are killing me.
Pretty tired, huh? Waiting here all night.
Sure, I'm tired as hell. Lots of guys are more tired than me. Anyway, it doesn't matter much how you feel. You know what you got to do. I'm here to do it.
How about you, mister? You from Brooklyn, too?
Yeah, that's right. I'm Dave Cowan from Heck Street over in Brooklyn Heights.
Well, how do you feel about all this?
Well, I served 3 years in the Philippines with the 60th Coast Artillery. Hey, listen, you guys. We got a tough job on our hands. I know the Japs are good.
Yeah, well, wait till we get out.
I guess
there.
That's right. Sure. And how about you?
I come to volunteer, please.
Say, you ain't a Jap, are you?
Oh, no, no. My name's Edward Tong, 240 East 30th Street. I am Chinese.
Oh, I see. Excuse me.
Makes it easy to want in service with Japan enemy. Gaspard turned me down. Bad eyes. Maybe want me now, yes?
Well, good luck, Mr. Tung. How about you, lad?
Me, I'm from over on Bricker Street. My old man's got a grocery store there. I'm Italian born.
Well, don't you know we're liable to be fighting the Italians?
Sure. And the Germans, too. That's all right for me. I'm an American.
Voicing the thoughts of the vast majority of the American people, this recruit was right. For today in Berlin, Adolf Hitler addresses his Reichstag of stooges, declares war on the United States.
Adolf Hitler!
President Wilson deceived Germany. Now, between your Führer and President Roosevelt, there is a worldwide abyss. President Roosevelt failed to recognize the new order. He failed to recognize certain newly established governments. On the other hand, he recognized puppet governments with no territory. The army tried to prevent a break with the United States, but our patience has come to an end. So now, Italy and Germany, in loyal fulfillment obligations under the Axis Agreement, associate themselves with Japan in a struggle against America. No one will vanquish Germany. No one will destroy German unity. Germany is strong. Let us thank God we can echo our name in the history of the Reich.
At the same time in Rome, another stooge of Adolf Hitler's, Benito Mussolini, addresses his people from the balcony of his Palazzo Venezia.
The powers over the Axis fought to sail against fascist Italy and the National Socialist Germany, ever closely linked. participate from today on the side of heroic Japan against the United States of America. The formidable blows which have already been inflicted to the American forces in the Pacific. Do you have prepared are the soldiers of the Empire of the Rising Sun? I say to you, and you will understand, that it is a privilege to fight with them. Italians, once more arise and be worthy of this historical hour. We shall win.
President Roosevelt drafts his second war message in 4 days, and this time in only 135 words, asks the Congress to extend the theater of this nation's war to the two remaining Axis aggressors. At 1:04 p.m., without debate, without one dissenting vote, the Senate and the House of Representatives obey the request. Today, the U.S. Army Air Force lifted the hearts of all Americans with a major achievement. U.S. Army bombers rise from a Manila airfield with orders to engage the enemy off northern Luzon. The commander with his flashlight behind him reports.
2250 to Manila.
Go ahead. 2250.
Reconnaissance was right. Target sighted. Japanese capital ship. About 29,000 tons.
Okay.
We are over target. Signing off.
Okay, 2250. Good luck.
Six.
Yeah,
stay
here.
You aim for his fire control tower. Here we go. Two five oh to Manila.
Go ahead. 2250.
One of our bombers scored repeated direct hits on a Japanese battleship with a Congo flag. When the bombers left, the battleship was blazing fiercely.
Nice going, 2250.
That's one for the boys who got it in the barracks back at Hickam Field.
This was America, this first week of its Second World War. For the war was now truly a world war. A war with fronts on every continent save one. A war involving six more nations than its terrible predecessor. In a fireside talk from the White House, the U.S. war president has reminded his warring people of this. Promises them the truth. Promises them victory. But foresees a long, bitter struggle, bad as well as good news. For the U.S., the war had got off to a bad start. But to a nation finally unified through war's reality, these opening disasters would be of small account. The U.S. had embarked on the greatest adventure in its history, to make the world really safe for democracy. Time marches on.